I think there's a lot of C-suite people. If you really went up to them and said, do you know your customer? Do you really, really be annoying? Do you really, really know your customer? And then if you had several layers of toddler why's, you'd get to the fact that the CEO of this company has never personally asked his customer directly how they feel about 100 different issues.
Stand by, I'll be right there.
Hello and welcome to Minter Dialogue, episode number 365. Today is Sunday the 22nd of March, 2020. My name is Minter Dial and I'm your host for this podcast. If you like this show, please do think to rate us. And if you haven't subscribed yet, don't forget to do so to catch all of the future episodes. Today's interview is with John Burkhart. John is a speaker, content strategist, and author of several books, including Newsjacking and Hacker Maker Teacher. He also co-founded Fast Forward Forum, the ultimate non-conference where guests share the stage. In this conversation with John, we discuss the issues, challenges, and some solutions for brand marketers in today's rollercoaster world. How to create a powerful brand story and generate standout content. We also look at how to supercharge your webinars. You'll find all the show notes on MinterDial.com. Now for the interview. Well, well, well. John Burkhart, great to have you on the show. When I was preparing for the chat, it's not very often I meet somebody, only now, where someone with whom I share 54 connections on LinkedIn. And by the way, I'm very selective, so I feel like that is something. In your own words, Dave, John, tell us who you are.
Okay, so I am a very curious person who happens to channel his passion into his work, despite what people say that that's a bad thing. I have been finding a way to love marketing by trying to work for brands that I care about in sport and in travel, and genuinely helping them be more curious with their content.
Well, that sounds like a great place to be. You're a man full of energy. So you are a speaker, author of several great books. And the last one I saw, you contributed to Fast Forward Files, right?
Yes,
Tell us about the FFF.
So Fast Forward Files is the book from the conference. And the conference is Fast Forward Forum. And be very careful when you're in the Balkans, because you may find yourself with a crazy Austrian dancing on bollards and dreaming up an idea for what I called an unconference, because I couldn't think of another word for it, but one where we get a small group of hand-selected people coming there to provoke 18 minutes on stage, interactive thing with a lot, where the questions and answer period afterwards was more important than the actual speeches, because it was all crafted on provocation and then turned into a book within 31 days.
Wow. Well, that's of course how we really shook hands for the first time, thanks to Carla Johnson, who's also part of the FFF.
She is my double act partner. I got her involved in our first year. We met on the dance floor at Content Marketing World, and I just saw someone that I wanted to be with, and we care about the same things around innovation. Even the E word that you care about, empathy, is part of our performance as well. And yeah, Carla is one of my people. I would say she's one of our people. And then I have to go back and find out who our other 53 people in common are. I bet you it's these people that I love, that I feel like they're people that I would want to bring out of my pocket and pet them from time to time. It's those type of people.
Well, if any of them are listening, then give us a little shout out to
Please
both
do.
Of us. You were talking about in the Balkans this event, and you know, both of us being speakers, and the tragedy or difficulty of everything that's happened with the virus and stopping these in-person meetings. Yet I think that the thing that defines a great event is when the questions and answers and the networking is the strongest part. Because as much as you and I think we're great on stage and we've got great content, we're so smart and all this, It's really the Q&A where the engagement happens. It's really the over the tequila at night at South By or in the networking cafe sessions in between the conferences that where it happens. And the great thing about the event that you went to, and I got a little bit of a window into it, was the quality of the people in the room.
Absolutely. And what is really incredible, you can't always kind of you can't always know who you're going to talk to. I hate the fact that no conference organizer has ever like knowingly undersold their audience. They're always telling me, oh, we only have decision makers in the room. And then you get there and the decision makers were too busy to be there. So they sent their middle and lower management folks to be there anyway. So you never know who you're going to talk about. So when you can orchestrate your own conference, when you can get people that I call provocateurs, they were like a friend of mine, Mateo, who runs a sort of luxury jet company. He came along the first year. He, to me, genuinely, he was the most important person in the room because he wouldn't put up with any of our BS. He would be, are you sure about that? So, yes, I admit he probably has a little bit of devil's advocate in him. But I can honestly say the conversation was flowing as much as the late night whiskey, for sure.
So what do you get when you put a rebel with a devil's advocate?
Oh, wow. You get, you don't have much hair afterwards. I actually pulled all the hair out of my aging gray and red goatee beard. But I would say what you get is never a dull moment. You don't say random off-the-cuff things because you know they'll just be shot down. Either that or you do just for the fun of it to see what can you get away with, which is nothing.
You know, and just to finish on the idea of conferences today, it's almost like, especially in your case with this event that you co-founded, that you should sell the people in the room more than the people on the stage.
Absolutely. Wow. I really wish that for year three of the Fast Forward Forum that we could even go a step farther with our curation of the audience. Not enough energy is focused on who's going to be in the room, who's going to not put up with your BS, who's going to make it better, and also different temperaments, different personalities. What do you do with shy people at a conference? Right. And what you do is you orchestrate the whole event around movement. So you say, well, we're going to have Sandra in the pizza kitchen and then Haimo in the kids' playroom. And then Pete, we're going to have him in the gallery d'art in between the buildings on this island off of Venice. And with that movement and with the conversation flowing, you would just find quiet people laddering up to people that provoked them on stage, but they never, ever, ever would have asked a question publicly.
Right.
So they latched on. You could almost see the quiet vultures in between sessions because we literally had to walk like 5 minutes to the next talk, and you would see them just latch on to people and ask private one-to-one conversations. It was beautiful because and some people didn't speak English as a first language, which that was the official language of the conference, and so sometimes the speakers would latch on to the quiet people and say, you didn't really say much, but you've had a brilliant opinion on the WhatsApp group for the last year. What do you think? And I love being able to deal with different temperaments and different, so not all the loud people got a stage.
Like you and me, the extroverts.
Indeed.
So you work really a lot on branding and storytelling and also content marketing and marketing in general, but especially if you looked at the industries in which you seem to work the most, John, how do you describe the problem that brand managers, marketers are facing today, and how do you help them?
Okay, so the problem, I think, is simple, and it is exactly the position of your microphone, which is in my face. So a brand, when you stick a microphone in their face, they're naturally, it would be very foreign, like what I'm now doing physically is I'm moving your hand and the microwave away from me. it's not a normal action. They have a microphone. They want to shout. Who do they shout about? Who do they feel most comfortable shouting about? It's themselves. So if we take the microphone off of them, I'm going to give you an example because I have to, because I get excited. I am obsessed with similar things to what you're obsessed with. You're obsessed with Liverpool and the Philadelphia Flyers. So if you really had to just talk about how the Flyers are doing, maybe, you know, I could talk box scores, I could just give you highlights, but why don't we be vulnerable for a moment and go over to like a story that's unexpected based on a fan? Like, do you know what has just entered the Hockey Hall of Fame? It is one of the most embarrassing stories for the Carolina Hurricanes. It could be seen as this. What happens when a hockey team, their two goalkeepers get injured?
Right.
Do you know what happens?
Oh, the Toronto story.
That's amazing. So David Ayers, a 42-year-old recent kidney transplant, he runs the Zamboni on Toronto's ice. Toronto, I know Maple Leaf Sports Entertainment folks well from my sports marketing days, so I know David, who runs their connections, he would have been thrilled at this story, because essentially they have to, in the law bylaws of the NHL, they have to have somewhere in the building an emergency hockey goalie.
And even for the backup team.
Even for the other team, which is just insane.
It is.
So essentially, a Toronto native who's been a Toronto Maple Leafs fan for many, many years, probably all of his 42 years, because you know how Toronto are crazy into their hockey.
All Canadians.
Yes, indeed. He had to be the Carolina Hurricanes goalkeeper.
In real life.
They were injured. So the Zamboni driver padded up, and he let two goals in.
The first two shots.
So you're like, oh, my God. He's going to lose this because he's a Maple Leafs. He's a Leafs fan. And then something within his inner being, his 42 years, and he does train with the team, to be fair. He's an amateur, so he doesn't get money, but he gets, like, you know, free hot dogs or whatever. And he found it within himself after letting his first two shots in to make eight incredible saves, and his team, not the Leafs, his team, the Carolina Hurricanes, won. And he's gotten sponsorship deals. His hockey stick has gone into the National Hockey Stick, the NHL Hall of Fame. This is a story of doom and failure for the Hurricanes. It's this human story. It's imperfect. It's a random bylaw of the league. But I wish brands could embrace their perfection, embrace their fans, put their fans on the court. Mm-hmm. There's so many lessons for marketing around being curious and just going with something that feels wrong, feels raw. It's not perfect, but if we could bake this imperfection into our stories, this transparency, I think it would be less about shove the microphone in the star's face and more about what do the fans want to see? What are the stories that are raw and imperfect, like David Ayers, the kidney transplant, now National Hockey League hero?
All right, so of course I love that story, John. Fantastic. And a shout out to my friends in Toronto and Carolina, for that matter, but when you're in business, though, John, this seems so hard to do. And people have so many fears, and it's not going to be right, and someone's going to complain. So if you're talking to the CEO or the CMO, the chief marketing officer, how do you convince them to move towards that? Of course, they're not going to have the David Ayers in their cupboard.
Yeah.
But in order to get there, what are the mechanisms and arguments that you think are convincing enough to bring them along to be this rebel?
So I would have to say, unfortunately, we're going to have to throw out that cliche of prior planning prevents piss poor performance, the three P's of marketing, in different three P's. But I would say what we have to do is have a little session with the CEOs and literally come up with these, I call it, be the annoying toddler. So on average, toddlers ask probably 200 plus questions
why,
a day.
Daddy?
Yeah, and why is one of them. And after you get past the first why, you have an arsenal, a litany of three or four more whys coming where you want to just hurt yourself. So this, can you imagine a CEO leading a session amongst his, we'll say, let's say one of the Toronto Maple Leafs sponsors. One of the sponsors was in the arena there and
Bell.
Really, yeah, exactly, Bell. It was really, I have a jersey with them on it. What if they, and they were really struggling, they weren't getting maximum value, but what if they, I had a chat with Maple Leaf Sports Entertainment about this very thing, because they had a mop company. And they take their creatives to their sponsorship meetings, and they literally live brainstorm. And what most people would do is say, I'm sorry, the mop company is an inappropriate, it's a domestic good, it doesn't fit with the Maple Leafs arena. It doesn't, in this case, it was the Raptors, so it doesn't feel right. But instead, the creatives are like, whoa, don't throw that out just yet. What is, we have floor that we have to wax every, after every
game,
yeah, for the Raptors.
Basketball team,
yeah. So they found a way for, to weave it in naturally where the five on the floor, to announce the lineups. So, you know, it's the five on the floor and, the mops come out. This is who we're going to be mopping up or whatever.
The guards.
And, you know, everyone, you know, as a Memphis Grizzlies fan, Ja Morant is on the floor most of the time because he jumps over 6'7" Kevin Love to posterize him and ruin his life. So naturally, when you do lots of dunks, you will fall down on the floor and you got to bring the mops out. So I love the fact that any brand, if applying the right amount of creativity, can come up with a way to fit, in this case, sports sponsorship to fit a team. But I would say if we go back to non-sport related, then it's about having a questions, a toddler session. Ask, on average, the Daily Telegraph says that toddlers only ask 73 a day. I challenge you, Mentor, do you think your clients have asked 73 questions and have really gotten into the heads properly, this E word you use, empathy, where they really gotten into like the uncomfortable, not the rational, like wins the match, wins the game, but the uncomfortable questions of like, why does people come to our store to fight? Like with IKEA, that's one of my, what I call a firecracker question, because the reality is a lot of people get in arguments in IKEA. They realize that their partner has bad taste. I went to IKEA with my future wife 1 week before our wedding day, and I lost my Nokia N95 smartish phone at the time. I lost it in one of the sofas, one of the uncomfortable sofas that she picked out. And I just found out that she had bad taste. I'm marrying this girl in 7 days, and I don't like her taste. IKEA have built their customer journey around diffusing that conflict that couples have when they go to pick out their first flat together. And they know that's an uncomfortable truth, but that only came out as a firecracker question because they asked, I would say, on average, up to 73 to come up with what's the tension? Where's the truth and the pain? Which is obviously the definition of comedy. But where is when we're going to find our story, and our story of obviously is our customer story. That's what matters the most. When we're finding that customer story, how can we have imaginative answers, and how can we ladder it back to the empathy, and then just go out and test it? It's a formula I call quiet. Starts with questions, then apply imagination to the best questions, then do your word, artificial empathy, the E, empathy, see which ones of those imaginative answers really relate back to the person that just wants to fight in IKEA, and then just go out and see what works. Put them out on social, and you'll know based on the feedback and the traffic and the questions or the absolute tumbleweed what worked.
So in answer then, it seems that you need to get in touch with your customers and probably get some insights and data points. The thing that I've found always interesting with regard to this question is that, let's say that they're the same customers that might walk into a furniture store A and a furniture store B. So it's the same people that could have an argument, because they might also have an argument in furniture store A. The interesting thing is to try to create the independent story, or the one that's specific to your cases. And maybe because it's bigger in IKEA, you can scream a lot more. What are the insights that you can own? Because ultimately, the issue is it's got to be something that stands out for you, and is not something that can be owned by other furniture stores in this case. So how do you come across those things and own it more?
I think the example I gave you, bang on. You could go into this company on my high street in Ealing called Stressless. They make these really posh like sofas, and that insight could be relative to this Pitsanger furniture store. So when you go deeper into the customer journey, beyond just couples fighting, you go deep into the ethos of the brand. Mm-hmm. IKEA were the first to make people put their furniture together. Like, it doesn't come built. Mm-hmm. They've made their name on you put it together. And yes, it's been a difficult struggle. I can't put anything together to save my life. I read the instructions, which might as well be in Swedish. I can't understand them either. But what IKEA have spent a lot of time doing, because they're an international brand, is digging into the culture of the country that they're expanding into. Mm-hmm. They realized in India, no one puts stuff together. That's seen as a lower,
menial
beyond
task,
the class.
Yeah.
Yes, beyond your class. The people that go to IKEA would never do that. So they, to save the environment, they have rickshaws. They're all decorated in beautiful, artistic, natural to the region, part of India they're in. And they, you buy your IKEA furniture, they put it together, and they take it on the rickshaw to your house and put it together for you.
It's very, very culturally specific.
It's culturally, yeah. And all of these, the Indian folk that now work in the town in India that has the IKEA, they were trained for a month in Sheffield. They were asked loads of questions. Then they went back and they had to apply that Sheffield IKEA training to their culture, and then they just said, hands up, we're not doing this, letting people put stuff together. It's just not within our culture to do that. So they established that. And I love IKEA. I mean, I've had conversations with the lady who's the head of IKEA in the Netherlands, and she just, it's, they really, really try to be culturally specific. So those questions that you ask, they have to be related to your culture, your particular, something you can own. And I think India can own the sort of solar-powered artistic rickshaws that go and put your furniture together for you, because that's within their culture.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't get away with that in Sheffield, for sure.
So in brand storytelling, let's say that a lot of people grab mics and scream their stories. Mm. What are some of the tips or thoughts and lessons you've learned, especially with the clients you're working with, in crafting great brand stories?
So I think you have to go back to why a story. Why, when I think of a brand story, someone would say, oh, you mean that's your mission statement? Is that just the About Us part of your website? And then you have to say, no, that is not. It's not even your story. Your story is one aspect, but the brand story encompasses, as we've mentioned, customer stories. But I think we have to go back to what is a good story and what does a good story do. And a good story provokes change. And a good story is, it starts with the way we feel. These stories demand emotions. In the case of the hockey, it demands joy. It sparks that joy. It's the way we feel, but it's also the way we think. Stories, they have to pique and actually hold your interest, and get you scratching your head and thinking. And then finally, not only feel, it's the way we think, but it's the way we act. And I love that. I love that we can get a brand acting responsibly because of our green initiatives to be solar powered in the rickshaws that bring your furniture. Again, feel, think, and act. Once, so we can come up with stories that really ladder onto any of those three: feel, think, and act. And then we just have to then test them out to see which ones relate specifically, in the same way the people went back to India from Sheffield and said, nope, those stories ain't going to work in our country, but this solar-powered rickshaw, bang on, that's a story that will represent our people. Mm.
So of all the three words between feeling, thinking, and acting, the one that I feel is the hardest to convince top management to get into is the feeling one. Mm. And it feels weighed down with risk and parts of me that I'm not comfortable with. And so how do you, what kind of insights do you have to allow for a very intelligent, albeit C-suite, to get into or open up to, embrace the idea of feelings and the messiness that comes with it?
I would say you need to take them out of the C-suite and get them on the floor, on the factory floor, whatever, if it's a B2B client, on the shop floor, on the restaurant floor. But I was speaking at a conference in Denmark a few months ago, and the three words, I hate to admit this, but I think there's a lot of C-suite people that you could say, if you really went up to them and said, do you know your customer? Do you really, really, be annoying? Do you really, really know your customer? And then if you had several layers of toddler why's, you'd get to the fact that the CEO of this company has never personally asked his customer directly how they feel about 100 different issues. He may have read a spreadsheet, he or she may have read a spreadsheet about and seen some anecdotal evidence or blah de blah, but I don't know. I don't, until you get face to face with your customer, you know, Greg Dyke, when he took over the BBC, he made a point to going face to face with pretty much every employee and getting to find out how they felt. Of course, you start off with chit-chat and banter, and you, what do you think about this? But after a decent amount of time, if you're an empathetic human being, you get beyond thinking and you get into feeling. And that is where, once the C-suite knows how they feel, then when they say something that seems like marketing BS, then they're like, that is really going to ring falsely with our employees, which will then ring falsely with our customers, which will then lead us into a place where we're not going to grow.
So I'm listening and I'm thinking, well, I read the survey, I read the study, 350,000 customers want this. And it feels to me that that's where the comfort factor is for CEOs. And the other little voice in my head says, well, you know, I go down, this is one store, one customer I see. I can't make an entire strategic decision based on this. What's the role of intuition in your mind, John, as you work with your customers?
I think everyone will start with the data. And then I think you have to realize that there are, I think maybe even Gladwell wrote the book around outliers. There are little anomalies out there where they don't really make sense. Some of the things that the travel brands that I've worked in, particularly within adventure travel, some of the things they've had to do to surprise and delight their customers. You even mentioned one yourself when we're having a bit of pre-recording banter around your favorite, was it alcohol or was it gin?
Lagavulin,
yes.
Scotch,
yes, sorry. Lagavulin, Scotch. And how you had both bottles and then you went back to your hut and they had four. They doubled it. And they did the same thing for green tea with your wife. I actually genuinely think surprise and delight doesn't always confirm those. I think your humanity confirms those, mm-hmm. because I think on a spreadsheet, your expensive scotch, doubling that, knowing you and your love of it, you're going to lose money off of that provocation, but oh no, you're not, mm-hmm. because you have been telling that story. I'm one of our mutual friends, I'm sure, as Jay Baer and these talk trigger things that he's been talking about. Mm-hmm. That's a talk trigger that you keep telling people. Because I was, it. I mean, literally, when you were telling me that story, because I think back to my friends who work for these safari companies, I'm like, I want to go tell them that. I want to go tell them, yeah. like, Mentor has this story. Have yeah. you done that?
Yeah.
And they'll be like, that's going to cost us money.
Right.
You have people who love scotch that much. If you put four bottles, the next day you're going to have to put eight. If you put eight, you have to put 16.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, John, that is does not make financial sense. And I'm saying, my question to you is, then why don't you do it? Because
right.
Mentor is still talking about
that's
that.
That's it. And I'm going to mention the place because it's called Pinda Forest.
Oh, I love that. Because Pinda, you even told me the name of it, is like a built into like a repeat visit, right?
Yeah, so it's at the Pinda means to return in Zulu. So
good.
I shall return, said Mr. MacArthur, General MacArthur.
Yeah.
So also, you, in these days, it's become quite trendy to, even though we're speakers and we prefer to have in real person conferences,
yeah.
The idea of webinars and you, with your energy, I can imagine, what, for those of us who have to maybe do more webinars than we're used to,
yeah.
In any event, what would be some of your secret tips and tricks for making a webinar successful or engaging?
Yeah. Oh man, this is one of my hot topics. I even tried in your love of the portmanteau with your artificial empathy. I even tried to create my own portmanteau of webinar, because it's a weird word, webinar. It's like, first off, we don't talk about the web that much, and no. Seminar has never been sexy. So the fact that that's already a portmanteau, and then you're going to portmanteau on top of that, is just too much for a human brain. So I invented the term, which I've taken off my LinkedIn because it just freaked people out, game. NR. So a game, because I'm all about games, and that I think people remember things better when it's a competition,
and
also
fun.
And it's fun, and I'm all about helping brands have more fun. But a webinar, whether you do a lot of games or not, the whole nature, what I find is we have to think of the customer journey there. When do people do webinars? A lot of them are at lunchtime, but then you have people who are not in New York, and yeah. So lunchtime is different for everyone. A lot of, you know, when I do them in for Madrid folk, they're at 7 p.m. Spanish time, 6 p.m. UK, London time. And I've now, all of my webinars start with alcohol. I always am drinking usually a Spanish beer if it's in Spain, or Portuguese if it's from Portugal. My football team are from Portugal, obviously, Wolves. Wolverhampton Wanderers, we are Wolves. But first off, how do you make people feel comfortable instantly? I think brands should always start with that. Instantly, people feel comfortable with me. A, them knowing that it's an interactive thing, that they can just literally interrupt me at any time. I do that in my live sessions with people throwing balls, because they know that that's something that's in their hand and that's going to get a response, because
so
it's going to literally physically stop me.
So in the conference, you're speaking in session and you hand out balls to everybody?
Yeah, so everyone's got a ball, and I usually always have one with me. It's probably, I'll get out my balls for you right now,
the
Mentor.
The audio version.
Yes.
And it's
yeah.
not those ones you're
yes.
thinking of.
They are ginger. Hold on.
Would like your hair.
No, yeah, that was a notebook. But no. I always have like what they're essentially is branded stress balls. And people, when at the right time, I get people to vote on whether they think something is ballsy. It's a brave, actionable, likable, long-lasting, surprising, and eccentric. It's just another one of my acronyms. But it really empowers people, A, to be on the edge of their seat listening, because they're waiting for their time. I hate to admit it, but we're all selfish. And if you know that there's going to be a time when you get to do something physical, like you're on your edge looking for that time. So I drop in little hints and I build little moments of tension of like, we're probably 10 to 15 minutes away from X, or in the time we have left, Y. And then people think there's a game show coming. There's a question and answer coming.
Mm-hmm.
But then you layer them upon story after story, and then drop in little reminders of what you're learning along the way. I think everything I learned about webinars, I learned in kindergarten, because I think in kindergarten you have to like sit in the right place and you have to do this. But you also, it's fun, you know, to get these kindergarten people's attention, these kids' attention. You got to be having fun at every moment, or they're just gonna, you know, go back to sort of spitting on each other.
So even if it's hard to keep kids' attention, the same thing goes for webinars. And the challenge, there are two types of challenges I'm thinking of. One is nothing, as in no response. They're all sitting, and then they have a different culture, and they're very shy behind their typewriters. They don't like to communicate. And the other one is the diatribe, the tweet wall with just nonsense going on. Hey, the chicken was horrible at lunch. It's too cold in here. And so those type of tweet walls can just be a wash of too many things. And then the other one is silence. Mm. So what tips can you... What would you give as guidelines to avoid both of those problems?
So, first off, I want to turn it back on you for one quick second. What do you think about Twitter chats? Are you always intrigued by them? Do you participate in them often?
Twitter chats. Yeah, no, for sure. So offline, if you will, in general, I enjoy some conversations on Twitter.
Yeah.
So of course, there's some good and there's some bad, and I can choose to, as an individual, to participate in them. When you're managing a webinar and you're inviting interactivity, Twitter is an avenue. You can also use Chatter or Slack or other ways, or the interface inside the webinar, WebEx, whatever.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So, I mean, for me, obviously, I've taken part in Twitter chats. My first book, Newsjacking, was written all about using Twitter in real time. Mm-hmm. But I still don't think... it's a perfect forum, a Twitter chat, for the way our brains work. I think it is what it is, and we're kind of conditioned because we love Twitter and we're loyal to it.
Yeah.
But when I, it'll come out of my brain now. But there was a web conferencing format that had it divided into four. It got major traction amongst the marketing community 2 years ago. And if I liked what you, Mentor, were saying when we had a little four-person chat with Mark Schaefer and Ann Handley, I could just press this button and it would float high fives up to you.
Oh, nice.
The name will come to me in a second, or we'll put it in the show notes. But it's no longer there anymore. But it was a beautiful little web conferencing format. You could only have the four big faces. Right. But I'm chatting with one of the big players in web conferencing right now, because they have this room that has this interactive whiteboard, and I can do a webinar and I can draw diagrams and I can have live sort of whiteboard feedback, and I'm loving being able to implement a lot of these ways to get people to respond in a way that is beyond just their voice. Because right. I feel like when I did the one in Madrid for a big consulting firm last week, I felt like 20% of them were willing to speak on the microphone and interrupt with me. 67% were willing to type something into the chat, but I wanted something that everyone could feel.
Something easy.
Like giving me a big mano-a-mano high five would have been perfect, just so I had some feedback that my retelling the story of how they decided who was the best player in the world, Ronaldo or Messi, and they decided by putting cigarettes in the Messi to clean up the world, because people drop cigarettes a lot. They cleaned up cigarettes, and by putting them in the Messi slot, you're voting for Messi by putting your cigarette there, or the Ronaldo slot. Little things where I felt like, I bet you they love this, but I don't know for sure. Mm-hmm. So the webinar is an imperfect beast, just like the word is imperfect, but the reality of me taking up your time on a evening in Madrid when the weather's nice, I want to make that so much like a pub chat. And I know that I have done that, and I know I haven't always succeeded to the levels that I wanted, but I think it's because the technology is not perfect yet.
Right.
So I'm working and talking to tech companies often. One's even in my neighborhood, and they want to allow me to use their room technology and test it out, and the digital whiteboard and the instant response. I think there's ways that you and I can travel less, because I would love to just travel 1 week max out of the month and maybe hit two or three countries in that time. But I think we can still engage as performers from our garden offices.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I love this idea of making sort of small, easy, quick, winny kind of interactions for the more timid. You know, it's like an Instagram story. You put a like and it flies up and, you know, that kind of a thing.
But imagine just having four options there. Like if you and I are doing, for the sake of argument, we're doing a webinar, Anne Hanley, Mark Schaefer, yourself, and myself, there's a little moment where we get audience feedback of, okay, all four of our pictures have just become interactive. You can draw on the face of the person you're connecting with the most, and you know, because she's brilliant, Anne Hanley would get mustaches drawn. She'd get people doing little flames on her glasses and stuff, and then you and I would have like crickets, like no one would be, because she's just really has a crazy use of language. That would just be in that one instance. That's, of course,
Mr. Schaefer would get plenty of good things too.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so John, it's been great to have you on the show. We've got
Thank you, so many more things
we could talk on. So shout out to Mark and Han. How can someone track you down, follow you, find out what you're talking about?
So at the moment, and that's changing in the next month, thanks to encouragement from my people, LinkedIn is the best place. So find me on LinkedIn, JonBurkHart. I'm exactly that on Twitter, and that plus TBC, which could stand for truly ballsy content if you want it to, or the Burkhart Consulting if you don't like balls,
or to be continued,
or to be continued, or trends, brands, content, trends, brands, culture. I've come up with 100 different things that TBC stand for. So then you could check back in the month of April when my developer finishes my new site, which will be tbcglobal.com. Wait for it, keynote speaker live, live.
So beautiful. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Mentor.
Thanks for having listened to this recording of the Minter Dialogue Show. You'll find the show notes and other blog posts on MinterDial.com. If you enjoyed the show, please head over to iTunes to give a rating and review. And to finish, here's a song I wrote with Stephanie Singer, A Convinced Man.
Challenge, I know soon we all die. I like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger to feel free. Trust in my reason and let me show you why. I'm a
Hey friends, this is Jim Knight, former 21-year Hard Rock executive turned best-selling author and top 10 keynote speaker.
And I'm Brant Menswar, former frontman of Hollywood's most dangerous band turned top 10 motivational speaker and best-selling author.
We host the how-to podcast Thoughts That Rock, where we talk to rock stars, athletes, CEOs, astronauts, and even next-door neighbors who share their expertise and opinions. Together, we tackle the most interesting and challenging topics of today.
Whether you want to learn how to become more confident, how to deal with anxiety at work,
or how to write a hit song, or use Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in life,
we've got hundreds of episodes to help amp up your life and move you forward.
Subscribe to Thoughts That Rock wherever you listen to podcasts, and check out evergreenpodcast.com for more information.